My name is Nancy Farrow, also known as Mama Lou, and I'm the founder of Epic Experience. Epic Experience's mission is to empower adult cancer survivors and thrivers to live beyond cancer. I hope that as you listen to Campfires of Hope, Living Beyond Cancer, you find hope, healing, and empowerment. Through stories and education, we aim to guide those impacted by cancer, and more importantly, offer love and support to anyone out there who needs it. This is Beyond Cancer.
Father Time's dance through the night, we can go somewhere to find. Well, he's still on our side.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another episode. Today, we're going to be getting a personal experience with an Epic Experience camp. And we're going to be talking to Jason, aka the Canadian. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
Great. We are so happy to have you. Thanks for coming on with us. So we always like to start just having you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, background, and of course, one fun fact.
I am currently 38 years old. I live with my wife, Leslie, and our 21-month-old daughter, Kira. We live in a small little kind of rural community in Ontario called South Mountain. We're about 40 minutes away from Ottawa. And yeah, just a very typical rural kind of family. We love being outdoors. We love just taking in the fresh air, having our bonfires. And we have a lot of family around that we really enjoy spending time with. I professionally, I'm a firefighter, and I also do work with, so we have, it's called EAL, so it's equine assisted learning. It's basically, helping individuals do personal developments with the help of horses. So that's kind of what I do on the side as well, to help give back and help folks kind of develop and find their way and try to support them through that. I guess a fun fact. Embarrassing/fun, but I'm absolutely terrified of birds.
Birds?
Yeah.
All sizes? All types?
All. If they flap their wings, I want nothing to do with them.
I have to ask, do you know why? Do you know where this started?
I had a bad encounter with a couple of seagulls when I was a very young age, kind of swooping in and grabbing some food out of my hands, and for some reason that just ever since, that flapping noise, I just can't do it.
Completely understand that. Yeah. Wow. Well, that's really cool that you do the work with horses and that you're a firefighter. Very cool. So you grew up there? You're in the same kind of area where you grew up?
No. So my wife definitely grew up in this area. I was born in Montreal, and then our family moved to Ottawa when I was about 13. 13 years old. And we actually lived in the city for my entire kind of, I guess, teen years. And then once Leslie and I met, we lived in the city for a couple of years together and then decided to kind of get back out. Or she wanted to get back out rural and I wanted to get rural. So we ventured outside of the city limits and we'll never go back.
Awesome. I love it. Well, let's get a little more personal. Let's talk about your cancer diagnosis, kind of the events leading up to it, how they came to the diagnosis, you know, what you went through, surgery, treatment, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, for sure. So to be honest, the beginning of my kind of cancer journey is not very exciting at all. I have no family history of colon cancer or cancer for that matter in my family. I had very, very minimal symptoms, really not much at all, to be honest with you. I had kind of one or two, that really stood out, but, because I've always been a kind of an anxious person, like I've had high anxiety, stressful work and all that. So a lot of the kind of GI issues I was having, and at that time being 36 years old, it was, oh, you're stressed. It's inflammation. It's hemorrhoids. It's, you know, the 100 other possible things that it could
be. Exactly.
Because beyond that, like I'm healthy, active, eat well, and there was really no reason to think anything beyond something quite simple. However, I went to see my family doctor and was super, super supportive. And she actually offered like, hey, like if you really want, let's send you for colonoscopy. Cause I did bring up the fact that, you know, I play in the Dr. Google game, which
of course,
you know, we all do and know we shouldn't do. And of course, a couple of the symptoms I was having that were kind of continuous were kind of, it always kept coming up like colon cancer, rectal cancer, colon cancer. So obviously that kind of, I thought at that point, I honestly was not worried about that, but it was kind of just lingering a little bit. So I brought it up to my GP and she, so she offered to schedule a colonoscopy. This was all mid COVID. It was right in the middle of COVID.
We
in Ontario here, we're basically on a complete full lockdown. Nothing was open, like doctor appointments and everything. You're by yourself. There's no family, no visitors, no nothing at that point here in Ontario. So, essentially, my GP kind of let me know that if anything got worse or changed or whatnot, and I didn't want to wait until that colonoscopy date, which was probably going to be a couple months, and because it was not urgent at that point, there was really just kind of more investigative or peace of mind for me, as opposed to that she actually wanted to see the results. So she had kind of mentioned, if anything gets worse, go to the ER, right? Like, you know, just now things can go a little quicker there. And especially if stuff changes, right? So I'd say about a couple weeks later, I was actually in Montreal visiting my grandparents' grave sites, which we do kind of regularly. So, and for some reason, I just kept having this inkling of like, just go to the hospital.
Really?
Yeah. It was really, really strange. And I definitely kind of believe and experience and like, I think there's more out there. And I don't think that was 100% it, but I definitely do find it very ironic that everything kind of happened that day when I was there. So, and I was in my head, I was driving home and just didn't go to the hospital. So I came home and I had a good chat with my wife, and she obviously knows kind of the way I work and what kind of really can kind of send me on a spiral. And she basically, you know what, like you need answers for this. Just go to the hospital, just go, right? Even if, you know, you have to pull the card that maybe things are a little worse than they really are just to get seen.
Yeah.
What have you, right? So basically I went to the ER and I saw the ER physician and they had asked me about symptoms and some of the kind of general, I guess, things that I was experiencing anyway, some of my symptoms were, I had very, very little, a very small amount of blood in my stool. It was nothing overly concerning. Again, it was, that's why it was very, we kept going back to hemorrhoids, inflammation, the colon, what have you, right? So fatigue, but I don't know if that was just in my line of work. It wasn't a debilitating fatigue, but I definitely was a little bit more tired and I started to get some kind of a little bit of discomfort in my abdomen. I wouldn't describe it as, it was nothing overly concerning. It was nothing debilitating, nothing close to that. It was just kind of nagging. So you don't think anything serious of just, you know, they're pretty, they were quite subtle, right?
Yeah.
Kind of from that point on, I saw the ER physician and he was awesome. Now looking back, like his bedside manner was terrible. I did not like him initially at all. But then when he was doing his exam, he brought up, oh, maybe it's diverticulitis. Again, I kept hearing the same things over and over, right? So before I even had a chance to say anything, this ER physician actually said, I want to prescribe you some antibiotics. However, I want to do a CT scan just to confirm what we're looking at to make sure I give you the right course of antibiotics, whether you just need anti-inflammatories, whether you need NSAID, whatever. Like, he just wanted to know what exactly he was dealing with to basically get me the right intervention. So that move on his end there was 100% lifesaver for me, because that's kind of what kickstarted everything, right? Like, it was really late at night and I went to like a small little rural hospital where we are. So they basically said, hey, we'll do your imaging, come back in the morning. and we'll kind of go over results or whatnot. So I went back that morning, did a couple other procedures. I was sitting out in the ER waiting room, literally just expecting, waiting for someone to come tell me, hey, here's your antibiotics, be on your way, you know, good luck to you.
Right.
But of course, that was not what happened. So I was waiting. I probably waited about half an hour, which no big deal, right? Lots of people there that needed way more attention than I did at that point. So then an ER doctor kind of opens the door, calls my name, and kind of just waves me over. And I wasn't even expecting to be brought back, to be honest with you. Like, I thought he was, here's your prescription.
Nice. Right.
see you later kind of thing. Yeah. But then I got, I just need you to come with me. So we walked through a couple different bays. We got to kind of a small little waiting room-ish type of area. And there was beds, and it was kind of like, so he sits me down and he sits beside me. And at this point I could tell his body language was not good. Like, he was not just, I could just feel something was up.
Yeah.
He was just super head down walking. Like, he was just, you could tell he was very uncomfortable. And of course the doctor sitting down beside you on a bed, like, I'm, you know, like in my line of work, like I kind of know a little bit about that stuff. And in my mind, mm-hmm. I'm like, what the heck, this guy sitting? You sit down if you're having a long, serious conversation, not just to,
you know, talk for a
minute or two.
Right.
Yeah. So at that point, I still absolutely did not think it was cancer whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I had no idea, to be honest with you, right? Like, so we went back, he sat down beside me. He turned to me, he held up a piece of paper, and he basically said, we have your results back. And there is a 2.5 centimeter tumor in your sigmoid colon. Mm-hmm. That we're seeing on the CT, and there's some lymph nodes in the area that look to be quite enlarged.
Wow.
So of course, at that point, the way I kind of described that moment, like now, I guess sometime later, having a bit more clarity on it, the room, the walls were closing in. It was an instant. I felt that instant adrenaline kick, heart pounding, everything was tingling and numb, and just, it was like a switch. And my first instinct, I basically said, okay, who do I call? Like, I need to call my wife, my family. Like, what does this mean?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And that's of course, that was the very first time that I heard the words, well, we're pretty sure this could be cancer we're dealing with.
Yeah.
So of course, at this point I was gone. I was frozen at this point.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of things that were happening the rest of that day, test-wise, but essentially what the plan was they wanted to do like an emergency endoscopy to try to get a biopsy, mm-hmm. To try to just kind of speed things up. They weren't sure if they were going to be able to do that simply just because they didn't know exactly what they were doing, like looking at, because often like CTs and colonoscopies could show very different things.
Yeah.
So at this point, I've already called my wife. And again, being during COVID, she was not like initially allowed in. But that day, again, I have been just blessed with a bunch of amazing people that I've come across. And the nurse I had that day was incredible. Like, she was just, we were very similar in age. So I think she kind of, we connected on that level. She brought in a couple warm blankets, put them over me, sat down, you know, go through, hey, who can you call? What do you need from us? What can we do to kind of, you know, just help you right now? And I said, well, my wife's on the way. Is there any possible way she can get in here? And of course, the nurse was kind of like, oh, COVID. Like, and this was kind of early on, but like there was lockdowns, but like the rules were so all over the place that nobody kind of really knew what was what and who knew, like the what was exception was like, it was a big jumble at that point, right? Just like I'm sure it was for you guys down there.
Was this like spring of 2020?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So very much when everything was still pretty chaotic.
Right.
So this nurse, again, super fortunate, grateful. I had no words to really describe this nurse, but she literally said, well, you tell your wife to go to the front counter and ask for me when she gets here. And I, to be honest, I didn't know what that meant at this point. So again, that happened. I would say probably about 25 minutes later, I saw my wife walk past through the curtain. Wow. And yeah, so that was a pretty heavy emotional, very kind of big moment there. We still didn't really have a lot of understanding what was going on. So again, another kind of really lucky thing that happened that day is my GP, she works emergency room shifts at this hospital. So she got alerted that because I was her patient, she had some red flag pop up that I had checked into the emergency room. So while I'm waiting and I'm sitting, you know, waiting for my wife to walk in there, she actually called me like on her day off. She wow. gave me a call and was like, "Hey, what's going on? Why at the emergency? What do you need?" And I kind of gave her a quick rundown of everything. And I guess very shortly after that, I was told that I was going to be having a consult with their general surgeon to, you know, try to get the endoscopy done. What I didn't know at the time was my GP and this surgeon were very good friends.
Wow.
So my GP had actually called him because he was on call that day, but basically called him and gave him a rundown of who I was, a little bit of a history, and just so kind of made that connection, which was, I mean, who does that, right? Like,
right.
who does that happen huge. To kind of thing? So this guy, again, he was a ex-military-ish type of guy, like terrible bedside manner, again, but got the job done. He basically came in and said, "I want to do this today. I'm going to make sure we get Jen upstairs." The operating room was full for that day, but again, just the way the day happened, he got a half an hour time slot in there to get this done. So I was then the fortunate recipient of a very quick hospital induced bowel prep, which was
miserable.
Absolutely miserable. I don't know if anybody that's going to be listening has ever experienced one at the hospital, but I hope you do not have to. It was quite the experience. But with that being said, it got me to where I needed to be. And we were able to actually go forth with the procedure. And he got the samples he needed. However, when I woke up, again, COVID, my wife wasn't there. She was in another waiting room waiting for me because she wasn't really supposed to be in the hospital. So she wasn't really up on that floor with me at that point. When I was coming to, I was not even really awake yet, to be honest with you, from the sedation. And my surgeon was standing next to my bed. And he basically said, like, "It doesn't look good." Uh-huh. And yeah. So he said, "We found what we needed to see. I got the biopsies that I needed to see. I will send them away for confirmation. But I'm pretty confident saying we're looking at cancer here." So of course, I didn't really take much in regards to that because I was still sedated. I was just waking up from a procedure.
There's that.
let alone the emotional exhaustion and turmoil and just everything from earlier that day. So, you know, I met my wife and basically kind of let her know what the doctor had said. And at that point, she obviously supported me and kept strong and kept the brave face on and, you know, really kind of helped me kind of take those steps forward to kind of keep moving on with things for that week because we were in a waiting game at that point. Right. So everybody in cancer land or who knows people or who work in kind of cancer land or whatever you like to call it is the good old waiting game, right? Like a lot of us absolutely despise. So we were told that we would most likely hear back in 3 to 5 days, which is quite quick for biopsy results. Mm-hmm. And went home, right? And it was a Monday. We went home. I actually hopped on a work meeting on Zoom that night. Of course, we were terrified, but we said we kind of decided that we were going to live that week as normal as possible until we actually knew something for sure. Mm-hmm. Right. So I definitely did not sleep. Anxiety was through the roof.
Yeah.
Some good solid tears, you know, a lot of talks and having to kind of let parents and some close people know, like, "Hey, like, this is what's going on. We're not sure yet." But doctors are, you know, they're pretty concerned. So we're going to wait on results. And then it was just day after day. Like, we were just grinding every minute, every hour, just waiting for that phone to ring, basically. Fast forward till Friday. It was probably around, I'd say, I forget the time, but it was probably around 3 o'clock, around 3:30, because it was very close to the end of a workday. And I was actually getting quite upset at this point, because I knew, you know, like, what surgeon works Friday afternoon or evening, right? Like,
right. And then you have the weekend.
Exactly. So I knew I was basically staring in the face of another 2 or 3 days of waiting for answers. So had my moments. I got into my car. I had a good yell. I let some frustration out. And literally, as I turned my car on, my phone rang. And the call ID popped up, and it was my surgeon. And I said, hello. How you doing? I said, oh, wonderful. You know, I'm waiting to hear if I got cancer or not. How do you think I'm doing, right? Like,
right.
I had a little awkward little chuckle, right? And he was genuine. It was just kind of a, you know,
anything,
right? It's just, it is what it is, right? So he was very straightforward. Like, there was no beating around the bush. He basically just said, it's exactly what I thought. They confirmed that it's adenocarcinoma of the colon. So I said, what the heck does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, you have colon cancer. So that was basically my confirmation. So that's the moments that I kind of knew for real it was happening. The test confirmed it. I had cancer. So again, the car, walls of the car shrinking in, kind of that feeling of adrenaline and like everything around me spinning, kind of kicked right in again. And I just wanted to get home. Like, I needed to get to my wife. Like, I just needed somebody, especially, you know, I was really hoping that that would be my wife. So I gave her a call to kind of fill her in. And she basically said, pull your car over and I'm coming to you at this point, right? Because I definitely should not have been driving.
Yeah.
Right. Like, looking back on it, but I mean, it is what it is, right? Like, yeah, I mean, you never know how you're going to react to that. And, you know, everyone, we all do kind of all different things. So I had parked, I got off the highway in this little like park and ride section or whatnot. And in all honesty, it was a big daze. By the time my wife got there, it was quite quickly after, but she had come up and I was walking up and down the on-ramp or the roads of the highway, just kind of walking, like pacing back and forth. I remember it very subtly, but there's a lot of that is just a big blur.
Yeah.
Right. So my wife pulled up, got in her car, hugged her, cried, was angry. We talked very briefly about what the doctor said and we went home. Right. So we drove home, and the next few days were just a lot of tears and a lot of, you know, my wife picking me back up and just trying to keep my head on straight. Basically, like, at that point I was drowning, I was underwater, and I was trying everything I could do to tread, like, until we got more information. So fortunately, in Ottawa, we have the Ottawa Cancer Center, and they are by far one of the top cancer centers in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And in Ontario, we have, we basically have regulations in place and like in our healthcare system that from the day you get a diagnosis, you have to be seen by an oncologist, or your file and everything has to be transferred to a cancer center within 2 weeks. It doesn't mean you're going to see a doctor within 2 weeks, but that has to be in their system, getting you loaded up and like kind of starting that process.
Right.
So again, we're in another window, right? Like, we're literally in another waiting window. And during that time was, again, a lot of fear, tears, panic attacks, you know, I remember my wife and I going to my parents' house and having to tell them that it was confirmed cancer.
Yeah.
You know, telling my wife's family, just telling friends. I had to tell my work. So it was, you know, a good 2 or 3 weeks of just slowly inching and kind of, you know, struggling through that.
Did you tell everyone, or did your wife? I know that's something we've talked about in different podcasts, is how people let others know. Did you take that on yourself, or did your wife also kind of take part of that?
So we did a little bit of both, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I had told my parents, I told my brother, I told some coworkers and some good friends. My wife helped a lot in regards to telling kind of, you know, her family and some extended family, like just people mm-hmm. that we wanted to know, but I couldn't do it. Like I couldn't do it. So she was obviously just like the rest of this journey. She was definitely instrumental in kind of literally pulling me through that. She came to my station with me and kind of stood with me while I talked to my chief.
Wow.
And because I, again, like that's not something I was able to do alone at that point.
Yeah.
So again, she really absolutely kind of carried me through that for sure. And then, yeah, like very shortly after that, I would say maybe, again, that 2-week window, I got a call from, you know, the intake department at the cancer center there in Ottawa. Mm-hmm. And everything kind of went really quick at that point.
Yeah.
So at this point, we are December 2020.
Okay.
So it was right around the holidays. Basically, nothing was happening during that. I had to have a whole bunch of scans, like CTs and MRIs and, you know, that they needed to be able to kind of pass on to their team to start making plans to move forward. My bowels weren't cooperating for a lot of them. I had to redo tests a whole bunch of times, which was super frustrating. Why not throw more tests my way, right?
It's right.
Not like
let's make you more uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Right. What's a couple other extra MRIs, right?
Right. So when did you actually get a plan, like for surgery or whatever they did in terms of treatment?
Yeah. So I basically got that plan right at the end of December.
Okay.
So it was December 28th. If I'm correct. And that's when we finally got a phone call. We had an appointment with a surgeon or an oncology surgeon. And that's kind of the first time that I realized that, okay, like we're doing surgery possibly, right? So we mm-hmm. kind of asked a bunch of questions. And because I was assuming I was just supposed to see an oncologist and we would chat and they would kind of let me know what the game plan is. So when my file got to the colorectal team, I guess they had brought, like their board looked at it and they kind of discussed, and because the tumor was fairly small, like it was really, and tumor, and, you know,
Tumorville.
In Tumorville, it was fairly insignificant. Like it was
right.
2.5, like it was 2.5 centimeter, like it was nothing big, right? So they had decided that they wanted to attempt a curative surgery first. Hmm. And then based off...
What do you mean curative? As opposed to what?
So they obviously don't know 100% until they go in. So their initial goal with my cancer, it was diagnosed stage 3.
Okay.
So there was no spread anywhere else. But with colon cancer, the big one is, if it gets to your lymph nodes or not.
Exactly. Right?
Because just like a lot of cancers, like that can be the difference between having a surgery and then being on surveillance for 5 years.
Right.
Or sorry, you need chemo because we got to clean stuff up just in case.
Right.
So my initial plan was to have a cure, like to attempt a curative surgery and be able to reattach my colon, reattach all the plumbing, like my surgeon kind of stuff. And not have to worry about like ostomies or any of that. Like their goal is to kind of get that tumor out and get everything back to as normal functioning as possible.
So when they say curative, they literally mean curing you of it to the point where you won't even need treatment like chemo or anything?
Correct. Yeah, okay. Correct. Yeah. Because at that point, until they confirm it's in the lymph nodes, like past and everything showed, it was only that tumor, right?
Okay.
So with a bowel or with a colon resection, which is what I had, is they literally took out about 8 inches of my colon on each side of where it was, mm-hmm. took that out and were able to attach everything back together.
Okay.
Which was quite incredible.
Yeah. So what they can do is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was February 19th.
Okay.
2021. My surgeon my whole team was incredible. It was a 4 or 5 hour operation, I believe. And I was in the hospital for 3 days after, which was quite short. I was pretty determined to kind of get back up and walk and like get home and kind of get on with things and help myself recover. Again, it was tough. Like this was mid COVID, right? So everyone's in masks and there's no visitors. And luckily there was an afternoon where on one of the days my wife was able to come visit. Like we didn't know who they were letting in or not. And then I kind of saw a couple of people had like single family coming in. So I'm like, yeah, just come on down and visit. Right. So she was able to come in for an hour, brought some, you know, food and tea and just some comfort stuff. Just, you know, and seeing her, of course, was huge at that time. And the next day I was home. So it was, you know, that morning I saw the surgeons. They were super happy, had nothing to say except for everything went exactly as according to plan. And they have zero concerns. And we have to, again, wait on biopsies, right? Because I had to send all the tissue and lymph nodes out to go get tested.
Right.
So that was about a 4 to 6 week wait, which, I mean, it was kind of a weird feeling about that because I was so focused on like just recovering from surgery, but you have kind of this lingering, hey, what's it going to be? Because with in my particular situation, it was literally if, you know, if A happens, then you're done. You're good. You don't have anything further. You know, you're just, we're going to watch you, take care of you, and you're kind of go back to life. And then option B was we got to do more stuff.
Right.
So it's a pretty like pretty drastic difference, right?
Mm-hmm.
So again, like I spent a lot of time recovering at home. My wife was again there for me and helped out a bunch. My parents came out a couple times. To add to everything, a week after being home, we got a call from the hospital that somebody that I was around tested positive for COVID.
Oh gosh.
So not that I didn't have enough stress going.
Exactly.
Right? So then it was that plus the fact that like I was around my wife, my parents were over, like I was around people for a week because they took too long to obviously get the phone calls out. So super stressed about that. So we had to do like the 10-day whatever isolation thing. At that point, I was already home for a week. So we only had 3 more days technically, which was not a big deal. But it's just kind of, you know, salt to the wound. They've got so much going on and why not that?
There's some more.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I guess fast forward, like I spent a good chunk of time recovering. I did a lot of walking. I did a lot of stretching and yoga and journaling and just a lot of stuff to really try to get myself, into a grounded space to kind of really gear myself up for whatever was next. Right. Because regardless of what avenue I would have gone, life is different and it was different and it was never going to be the same. Right. So I did a lot of work like with my therapists and, you know, a lot of different supports that I have, a bunch around the horses. They were a huge part of, you know, my healing. And then kind of the phone call came. Right. And, here in Ontario, we have like, or my hospital anyways, we have portals where you can like, you know, you go see your information. I know different states, like different places, just like there are different places do it differently. But the report got to my portal a few days before my appointment. So I was actually able to read my pathology report with my wife before we even talked to the surgeon. So unfortunately, I had 7 out of 21 positive lymph nodes.
Wow.
So I knew right there that meant chemo. I didn't know what the plan would be. Like, I didn't really know much, except I knew, okay, this means chemo. This is not over. So we had talked, you know, with the surgeon, and he was, again, really positive. Like, everything surgically wise went really, really well. And my file kind of got passed over to medical oncology at this point. But within a couple weeks, I was at the hospital, at the cancer center, meeting with my oncologist for the first time. Right. So at this point, 36 years old, I had a major abdominal surgery. I'm about to meet an oncologist and in the middle of a pandemic. Right. So it's, not the best time.
It's a lot.
yeah. There's, a lot, definitely a lot going on. So I just did not backtrack, but like from very early on, I really decided to take on an attitude of, if I'm going to get to the other side of this and I'm going to do it in my, like my own way, and I'm going to do it in a way that benefits others as well. Right. Like, I don't want to just, you know, so I used a lot of conventional stuff. So I used a lot of Western medicine, but when I met with an oncologist, I was very, very blunt and basically said like, hey, listen, like, I trust you. I respect you. Like, let's, you know, I want to build a relationship with you here, but I will be using a naturopath and acupuncture and all this. Like, I did use a lot of integrative stuff. I went to that appointment guns blazing because I've heard a lot of, you know, I've read a lot and have been told a lot about how, you know, a lot of oncologists are not, like, they're not supportive of that stuff, right? Like, it's one way and that's it. So I was very, very relieved when he kind of looked at me and he was like, that's okay. Like, settle down. I'm good with that. You know, like he knew I was getting pretty worked up, right? And he's like, take a breath. It's all good. He's like, I totally support that. So that was kind of a little connection moment we had at the beginning. And he spent, I think we talked for about 40 minutes. He went over kind of treatment plans or options. He told me a little bit about himself. He heads up the whole research departments within the cancer center. So he's a big research and study and kind of information type of guy. So he basically told me from day one, like, there's lots of stuff out there. If you find something, if you have questions about something, you bring it into me and we'll look at it. So, which was kind of cool.
Yeah.
I mean, of course I was terrified, right? Like, I was sitting there talking about treatment options and the nurses there were fantastic. They like gave me a tour of the cancer center, walked me around, introduced me to people. It was pretty nice. Like, it was just, you know, I definitely learned that, like, you get back from the medical community kind of what you give them, right? Like, it's pretty neat. So I left that appointment basically with three options, three treatment options. And so I basically had three treatment options. The first one was watch and wait. With my diagnosis, if I chose to do nothing, there was basically a 50% chance of cure, 50% chance of a possible reoccurrence. My option two was standard of care. And that was 6 months of FOLFOX, which is kind of the standard chemo treatment for colon cancer.
Okay.
Yeah. My option three was my oncologist was running a study basically with to compare FOLFOX and FOLFIRINOX, which is basically just a different combination of the same drugs that are used in a lot of other kind of colon cancer treatments. But they just wanted to see the difference in efficacies essentially.
So they would do both?
No. So how that study worked is they would randomize you into one or the other.
Okay.
You would either get the standard of care or you would get the new drug.
Right. Okay.
So I basically had to go home and I had a decision to make. I knew I was doing treatments, like watch and wait was not an option. You know, being 36 years old, like, yeah,
well, healthy, seven, like, lymph nodes.
Yeah. Like, not, you know, and just, yeah, exactly. It just wasn't an option. I was kind of going back and forth. My wife and I had a lot of discussions about kind of, did we do the standard of care? Do we do the studies? Like, what's the difference? Like, what's the benefits? After learning about what's involved in studies and how much more attention you get and how much more you're watched and how many additional like tests and imaging and coordinators and like people you actually gain on your team when you sign up for one of those, I was sold on that after a couple days of debating. I just felt like the more people I could have on my team, the more tests I could have access to, the more information, the more, like, that's just going to benefit me. Right. And on top of that, I'm going to be helping a study, which can help a bunch of other people down the road too. Right. So, that's the option I went for. So I decided to enter the trial. I got randomized into the FOLFOX arm, which is kind of funny because that's kind of what I was debating
right.
Between. However, because I was in the study, I gained access to all the perks.
Oh, that's cool.
Being a study participant.
Mm-hmm.
So what that meant was every 2 weeks when I went in for a treatment, I saw my oncologist in person instead of two times over 6 months, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had a direct line to my study coordinator, right? So if I had any questions, like I had access, I had direct lines to people. Like I wasn't going through like administrations and voicemails and, you know, extensions. And I had like, so it was quite amazing. And of course I was terrified. I was about to start chemotherapy. However, I was starting to get like, in a weird way, I was starting to get comfortable, right? Like,
right.
I could just speak for myself, but I hear this quite a bit. And the people I know that you talk to, you get very kind of like, everything starts to become eerily normal. Right. Like,
exactly. You just got to do it.
Yeah. And like going to the cancer center is now normal, mm-hmm. right? Like getting multiple phone calls a week from the hospital is normal. Right. And so it's just a very strange, like even now, like that I'm out of it, like even saying that, it's just, it sounds so weird. Right. But like in the moment and when you're living it, that's the reality, right? Like that kind of does your, it takes your life over. Right. So I started chemotherapy in April, and I did 6 months of FOLFOX. So I went from April, and my last chemotherapy treatment was September 24th.
That would be 2021, right?
Yeah, 2021. And during that time, so when I talk about my chemo, there's, I have a lot of guilt about it actually, because I had it pretty easy. It really didn't ravage me too much. Like mm-hmm. with that being said, I now looking back and doing a lot of work with like therapist, like mm-hmm. I did a lot of work to help that. Like mm-hmm. I did a lot of the right stuff, and I drank my water, and mm-hmm. you know, I went for walks when I felt okay. I was mm-hmm. using my naturopath and acupuncture, and
right.
So I did do a lot to help that, but there's some guilt there. Like I still know a lot of people you see that's not the norm.
Right.
Right. So, you know, when I talk about it, I'm very careful about how I describe it,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I don't by any means ever want to make it sound like a walk in the park, because it was not by any means. However, I do like to say that I really did not get a rough ride with it, you know, because I do know there's a lot of people, majority of people out there, have terrible, terrible times with it.
Yeah.
Right. And in a weird way, there is that guilt that was not me. But again, I'm starting to learn that, you know, it's so individual and no two people are the same, and slowly kind of, you know, learning to accept that.
Yeah.
But one of the cool things actually during my treatment is, so with FOLFOX, one of the drugs in FOLFOX, oxaliplatin, is really well known for causing neuropathy, right? Mm-hmm. So like messing with your hands and feet and so on and so forth. And in the States there, so I was part of Colontown and also Man Up to Cancer, which were two of my big supports. And I saw a lot of studies with Colontown that this process called icing, right? So
mm-hmm.
it was starting to be used in a lot of major cancer centers in the States, but had not yet made its way to Canada. So I'm like, hey, this is kind of cool. Like, why not give it a shot? Like, that's just kind of my approach to this whole thing, right? Like, why not do something that might be able to help? So I brought a stack of studies and papers and everything that some folks in Colontown that like I knew helped me kind of put together. I brought it into my next oncology appointment. I gave it to my oncologist and I'm like, what do you think? And he kind of looked at me and his first thing was like, are you telling me that you want to put ice on your hands and feet with a chemo drug that is known for cold sensitivity? And I'm kind of like, we had a kind of moment and I'm like, yes. Right. So, and he honestly did not hear it. He's never heard of this. So it was brand new to him as well. But his response like really impressed me. Like he sat there, he looked at the study, he read through it, he looked at the data, and we had a legitimate discussion about it. Like at this point, we had quite a good relationship. We both had a lot of mutual respect for each other. And we sat there and we talked about it. He was very open with me about what he liked about the study. He was also open about maybe what he didn't like about the study, or where, you know, there were some loopholes or things that he wasn't 100% sure about. So we talked, we spent about a half an hour talking about this. He consulted with a couple other people in his office and then kind of gave me the, you know what, if you want to give it a shot, let's go for it. The only thing I had to promise him was that if it wasn't helping, or if it was making chemo worse or whatever, I had to stop right away. So I'm like, no, fair enough. Like, I could do that, right? Like, you're kind of really taking a chance here too and trying something brand new. You tell me what you need me to do. So a couple hours later, I was the first person in the Ottawa Cancer Center to have ice all over me for my chemo FOLFOX treatment.
And you did it during treatment?
Yeah. Like, so for an hour, for 2 hours, I sat in the infusion chair with my hands in ice. And my feet in ice, and kind of just waited for the drip to be done.
And did it
help? It did. It actually really, really did. So, we're audio here, so I can't share it, but I came home after that first time and I opened my freezer at home and I stuck my hands right in the freezer and I didn't feel a thing. It was totally okay. So I took videos, I was holding frozen food. I was like, you know, and I wanted to bring back to show my oncologist, like, hey, like, look, like, check this out, right? This is awesome. So of course, with this chemo though, like, you go to the hospital for 2 hours, you do one infusion, and then you just get sent home with like a pump for the other drug for 46 hours, which is a whole whack load of fun too. So my chemos were every Friday. I would go to the hospital for probably about 4 hours, like between blood work and tests and all that jazz. And then I would come home, I'd have my pump. And Sunday, I get a nurse come to my house to kind of visit. And she would disconnect me, pump me with some fluids. And that was it for a couple of weeks. Like, that was basically a cycle for me.
Yeah.
I kept working the entire way through my 6 months of chemo. Obviously my roles changed. I did a lot of office training, like, yeah, not frontline stuff, but I was determined to not let this take anything away from me. I obviously did, you know, people around me did know if it got to a point that it was not safe, healthy, whatever, like, I was 100% willing to, you know, accept that. But I was head on determined that until that point came, like, I'm doing what I could do.
Yeah. I want to switch gears if I can a little bit to get to ask you that epic experience. So, so it sounds like you were kind of like in a decent headspace when you finished, right? Yeah. Because you had kind of been doing, so when you heard about epic experience, were you still kind of in that positive headspace? Like, what did you expect to get out of epic? And then what was the reality? Like, what did you actually get from that experience?
So this opportunity came up through Man Up to Cancer. I know you, like, Man Up to Cancer kind of got together and they decided to kind of throw a first guy's trip. And they, you know, luckily enough, we were the fortunate recipients of that, which was amazing.
Awesome. Yeah.
I didn't know what I was expecting, to be honest. At this point, I was at a point where I was well into my survivorship. I was probably about a year in. I've been done chemo and everything like that. But I was very much still in that weird space of trying to figure out, like, who am I now? Like, what do
now
I do
what?
Now? Like,
right.
Like, everything's kind of different, right? Like, all those appointments get ripped away from you and you don't have all these people around you anymore. And everybody around you expects you just to, like, be okay again because, like, your treatments are done, right?
Done, right.
But, yeah. But of course, as you know, and I'm sure everyone listening, like, that's not how it goes. So I was very much in a spot of trying to figure a lot of that out. And then this experience came up. Mm-hmm. And I remember when the first post came out about it, that Trevor posted on the site, I kind of read a little bit. I popped onto the website and kind of did, like, this is awesome. Okay, like, this would be so cool. Because, like, I'm an adventure type of person. I'm an outdoorsy person. Like, I love that kind of stuff anyway. But interestingly enough, like, I was looking at it and I'm like, I wonder if my body could do this anymore. Right. Like I lost a lot of stamina and muscle strength and just endurance. Like, I mean, you know, like I'm literally fresh out of like chemo. It's like the couple years of cancer. Right. So I was kind of questioning, like, could I even do this right now? Right. And, which was kind of, and I'm a very like determined, like, you know, probably strong willed person. So it was kind of a challenge to myself, right? Of first of all, could I still do this? Could my body handle it? Secondly, like, who on earth would not want to go to those mountains and like do some amazing things with some wicked people, right? And I thought it would be extremely healing. I didn't know how yet. I didn't know what. So I didn't really know many details, but I just had a feeling that I needed this. Like, this was something that I was at a point in my journey that I needed. Like, I needed something to help propel me kind of in my next phase there. So I put my application in, got all the medical stuff. Like, of course, from like being from Canada was a bit tricky because like we, things work a little different. So to get everything approved and like, it was all good. It was just a bit of a, you know, different medical system. So it was a little bit of a adventure. But I applied, and again, like, it's kind of funny because just like everything else in cancer land, I waited. I waited. And at that point, really no inkling on if, you know, if I was accepted. We didn't really know within Man Up to Cancer, like how many people actually applied. We knew kind of generally how many spots there were, but beyond that, like there wasn't, we didn't know. Like that was, it was kind of, these are the spots. I had no idea if 5 people applied or if 500 people applied, right? Because we have like a community of like 1700 guys who would, you know, most would love to do something like this. So I finally started getting a couple emails after a whole bunch of excitement, of emails of seeing Nancy's name pop up, being like, oh, did I get in? And it was purely just like updates about like COVID or like timelines or whatever, right? And I'm like, just email me, let me know if I'm in. Right. So finally, of course, like we got the email that I was one of the people selected, which was awesome. And again, still being in the pandemic, there was the, oh my gosh, now I got to travel to the States.
Right.
Right. So that was kind of part two. So yeah, like I, in all honesty, like I watched some YouTube videos, like I watched kind of the promos. I was on the site a little bit, and you know, there's some folks in Man Up to Cancer that have been on, like been on other epic camp trips years in the past years. So of course they were pretty vague, like we're all supposed to be after we go, but they were just like, you got to do it. It's going to be awesome. And yeah, like then it was just kind of just pack and wait and go back to life and work until kind of camp weekend came.
So then you went to camp. What did you take away? So what, like, what was the absolute, the best part about it? What did you take home to put back into life?
Yeah. So, I mean, there were so many, like, there were so many amazing experiences that happened that week on a lot of whole, like dozens of different levels.
Right.
But I think if I go back to a specific moment, and I'm going to try to be vague, but there was a moment where I kind of had a very big realization of this is what I'm supposed to be doing now.
Like, what do you mean by that?
Like now, like I'm in my survivorship, right? Like I got to have a lot of amazing conversations with some gentlemen there. Some people that, you know, experienced some rough moments, people in very different situations than myself. That's, you know, we're possibly doing this because they wanted to have some adventures that they didn't know how, you know, if they'd be able to do that ever again. And I just felt supporting them and getting to know these guys and like being kind of like, I mean, I'm fortunate, you know, like I get to be the guy that made it, right? And made it well and kind of had that textbook. If it could be, if someone could paint a picture of how a cancer journey should be from you go, right? And, it wasn't easy, obviously, like it was hell. I did a lot to help myself, but I kind of learned at camp that my role now is to support other people, like to show people that there is hope, right? Like I spent I spent a lot of time dealing with the fact that why am I the lucky one? Mm-hmm. Right. Like, so a lot of survivor's guilt, right? Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
In 2 years, 2 years of this community, like, I've seen people my age, older, younger, kids, like, just, not make it.
Yeah.
And I had a couple really awesome people that I got really close with and met up to cancer that, that had been around for a long time and, kind of told me that we need guys like you, right? Like, we need hope, because if we don't have hope, like, what are the rest of us supposed to do? Mm-hmm. Right. And I never really thought about it that way. Like, I was always very cautious about posting positive things or talking mm-hmm. positively, or because I knew, like, there's so many people out there that are just going through hell, right? Yeah. Like, so you feel I felt very guilty, right? Like, mm-hmm. that wasn't, I'm going through a lot and I'm still processing a lot mentally and emotionally yeah. and all that, but not on the same level as a lot of people I know.
Yeah.
Right. So, they gave those words of just, we need hope. Like, we need those positive stories kind of made me realize, like, that's my spot, right? Like, that's maybe why I am where I am. And maybe mm-hmm. my story went that way, because now that's what I'm going to get back to this community. Right. So kind of camp really showed me how important that is to me. Like, and I think yeah. how really, I don't even know the word. It's hard, right? What happens up there? But
yeah.
I think it really confirmed to me where I'm supposed to be right now.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I have one more question for you before we close, if you were able to talk to a newly diagnosed cancer survivor, whether it's somebody with colon cancer or another kind, what is something that you would tell them that you wish somebody would have told you back then? If you could just pick one thing, I'm sure there's a ton, we yeah. all kind of learn as we go, right? But if you could pick one thing that you wish someone could have shared with you back when this all started, what would you say?
I have one point, then I'll get to the real one, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
The big one, stay off of Google. And
yes.
My big serious one that I always tell people is utilize resources. Like, this is not something that happens. But utilize, like, make your team around you. Like, mm-hmm. don't think that you only need your oncologist or yeah. you only need your radiation oncologist. Like, get your people around you, like, get your naturopaths, your physio people, your counselors, like, surround yourself with as many tools and as big of a team as you could. Because this is not something to do alone at all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
100%. Well, the Canadian, thank you so much. Were you the only Canadian? I'm guessing you were the only Canadian at camp, and hence the nickname.
Yeah. Yes, I was.
Thank you so much for sharing your story, for being vulnerable about all of it, the symptoms, the struggles, mental, physical, all of it, and for sharing the hope that you came out of camp with. And I'm excited to hear that you're sharing that with others. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. It's an absolute pleasure. And I have no doubt I'll be making an appearance at some epic events at some point in the near future. So I awesome. Look forward to kind of seeing and checking in with everybody and catching up.
Perfect. All right. Thank you all for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Campfires of Hope, Living Beyond Cancer. For more information about Epic Experience and our programs, or to donate, please visit our website at epicexperience.org. Music for this podcast is provided by Moonshiner Collective. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review us so we can share our story with more people. Also, be sure to subscribe wherever you get podcasts so you'll know when new episodes are released. We hope you come back and join us for our next episode. By the time